Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
There's a new book coming out at the end of the month that takes on one of the most private, maybe most misunderstood parts of Mormon life. It's the temple garments worn by members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the book was written by three women, researchers and independent scholars of the faith. And it's built around a survey they conducted where they asked Latter-day Saints questions like, what do your garments mean to you, and how do you feel when you're wearing them? And the response to the survey blew them away, more than 4,500 in just a week. And one of the things they noticed in all of those stories was that the pressure to wear their garments as a sign of, you know, faith and obedience, to follow the rules, didn't come from leaders as much as it came from other members. The judging, the surveillance, the social expectations, all of that was coming from inside the community, not just from the top. One of the co-authors of the book, Nancy Ross, told us the perfect illustration of this is when Ann Romney, Mitt Romney's wife, went on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno in 2012.
She asked the American public to kind of set aside their prejudice or whatever they thought they knew about Mormons to elect the first Mormon president.
I love the fact that we have the first African-American president. Mm-hmm. That means to me that we're leaving prejudices behind. Mm-hmm. I would hope that if Mitt were elected, we would see more of the same.
And yeah, the next day, Mormon spaces were all up in arms about her underwear.
Now we're going to see the first Mormon president.
And of course, her underwear was not on display. But there were lots of conversations pointing out that with the length of her skirt and her sleeves, that nobody could detect garment lines.
Facts. She's been to the temple. She is avoiding garments to appear normal. She's wrong to do it if she is a believer. There is no excuse.
The Romneys will do or say anything to get elected. And not being seen in creepy Masonic underwear gives them a better shot at it.
And that this was scandalous. How can you show up on national TV and advocate for the acceptance of Mormons in public when supposedly Anne was not showing up as a quote-unquote real Mormon?
This isn't about her not wanting to put them on display under such scrutiny. It sends an obvious message of embarrassment.
Or maybe it's a personal choice reason and a decision Anne Romney has made on her own. Who cares if she isn't wearing garments?
Certainly in the minds of these people who were commenting on this, you know, wearing garments is a key part of being a Mormon. And how can Anne show up on television at this really key moment in Mitt Romney's campaign and advocate when she's not even signaling to insiders that she is doing Mormonism appropriately?
Anyone else think it's creepy that we're speculating about the underwear of a woman who is married to a presidential candidate? Or has our Mormon upbringing blurred those personal boundaries too much?
And Lisa Butterworth, the founder of the Feminist Mormon Housewives blog, which was a very popular Mormon feminist blog at that time, wrote a response being like, hey, can we not judge Anne for her underwear choices? This is not a very feministy thing to do. This is making us look real bad. We're doing the weird Mormon thing, and we're doing it in public. And, you know, the news moves on because, of course, it's an important election. And nobody lingers on garments for too long. But we have a lot of stories in this book, and we have a lot of personal stories. But we wanted to kind of begin with a story of something that maybe non-Mormons wouldn't remember, but something that was playing out and something that various media outlets responded to, picking up on these conversations that are happening in some of these social media spaces. So I think that for me, the sense that something is both hidden and visible and present and not present, and that our underwear choices are absolutely surveilled and discussed and judged by the church community, is really at the heart of the kind of communal and social experience of wearing garments. And that is something that we really wanted to forefront in the book.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The book is called Mormon Garments, Sacred and Secret. And as you can tell, it isn't about underwear. It's what these garments reveal about the faith and the culture, what it's like to live with them, you know, on your body. And as you'll hear, for some women, it's not easy. Some men, too, though for different reasons. The book is about how garments shape daily life, how power and authority move through these Mormon communities in complicated, sometimes surprising ways. It's also about the history of garments, which is also complicated, also surprising. Nancy Ross is with us today. She's an associate professor of interdisciplinary arts and sciences at Utah Tech University. She co-wrote the book with Jessica Finnegan, an independent scholar of religion, and Larissa Cano Kindred. She works as a clinical therapist. She's working on a PhD at Tennessee State University. And we should probably say up front here that this is a subject that's deeply personal and really private for people of faith. So it's not easy to talk about or write about. And that's where we began the conversation. Here's Nancy Ross.
I teach at Utah Tech in St. George, and so this is a very Mormon community. And there are a lot of church members at the university as well. Our forthcoming book was advertised in a recent academic report for the university, and we've already had a complaint lodged with the university about the book.
Wow.
We had institutional review board, ethics approval to do the survey that we did in 2014, but we got complaints as well at that time that this just wasn't an appropriate topic to be studying. And every time, really, I have talked about this topic in public, there are some complaints that we shouldn't be talking about this, just a general disgruntled, we're not supposed to be doing this work. We're not supposed to be talking about this. This isn't sensitive.
Yeah. It's one of the points you make early on in the book that Mormon culture discourages a discussion of garments with outsiders.
Yes.
And insiders. And you're right. It's a justification that the, as you put it in the book, the sacredness of such things warrants silence. So if that first rule is don't talk about your garments, what role has that played in what you explore as the problematic parts of garments, getting women? And, we'll talk about, those who are no longer in the faith or who have doubts and questions about the faith, but even active temple-going Latter-day Saints, that idea of silence, it must be a challenge to get them to also share the parts that they find problematic about their garments.
So what we discovered when we did this survey, and this was back in 2014, and there'd been very little survey work done in social media with church members. And what we found was, typically when social scientists do survey work, nobody wants to write in the box, right? Nobody wants in a survey, right? If you ask an open-ended question, very few people write in the box. Mm. And what Jessica and I found is that it was an anonymous survey and that people were kind of pouring their hearts out. Their stories, mostly their very sad stories with regard to garments, yeah, into the box. And that's, quite frankly, one of the reasons why it has taken us so long to work through this data to write this book, is because we have had to put it down so many times. It has been so heavy. Initially, we had a very simplistic hypothesis. Men and women experience their garments in different ways. We'll get maybe, if we're lucky, 500 responses, and we will write a journal article and we will move on with the rest of our lives like normal people. Yeah. And we got 4,500 responses in a week. Ultimately, we had to learn a lot of new data handling skills to be able to deal with the data we had. And it was devastating. You do not have to read too many devastating stories about people and their experiences with garments and the impact it's had on their lives to realize that very quickly that we, in one sense, bit off more than we could chew and digest very easily.
Yeah.
And I think for each of us, it has sent us on our own journeys of more unpacking and personal reflection and, you know, trying to understand the impact of this practice in our own personal lives. And that's been really hard.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to the part, the your theory that men and women were decidedly different in their experiences and with their garments. That surprised me. That spoiler alert, it didn't turn out to work that way. We'll get there. Let's begin with the basics, though. Even though most of our listeners are kind of in the know, I would think, I don't want to presume. So what are garments? What are LDS temple garments? Give us the basics.
Jessica, Larissa, do you want to jump in?
Yeah.
Garments are a piece of religious clothing that was introduced very early on in Mormonism by Joseph Smith. They're generally to be worn day and night. And we'll talk about this more, but, there's been different reasons for this that have been stated over the years. I think, but generally, it's been fairly consistent that members say that garments are meant to be a reminder of the covenants that you've made in the temple. They are white. They are a top and a bottom. They used to be one piece. There's been recent changes with garments, but the tops for women used to have a cap sleeve and were kind of almost like a camisole. And then the bottoms are like a short that goes down to the knee.
Right.
The men's kind of mimic, like an undershirt or a long boxer short. So the men's are more similar to traditional men's underwear, but the women's are very different from traditional women's underwear. And then they recently released a sleeveless garment that's been very, very popular.
Yeah, so, we'll get there too. That was...
Yeah. So this is like an ongoing, something that's evolving. So,
well, that's a part of the story is how the evolution here. But back to the idea of the expectation. They're expected, Latter-day Saints, once they get their garments, to wear them day and night throughout their lives, right? It's a real expectation. Is it seen as a kind of a, I don't know the language, is commandment right?
Yeah, I mean I think a lot of people would consider it a commandment, and there's some like built-in regulation to make sure that this happens. So members used to be interviewed once a year by their bishop, their ecclesiastical leader, and they would ask them specifically if they were wearing their garments appropriately. And now they do that interview every other year. And up until recently, they used to actually read something like some additional instructions that had to do with garments. And it would say some specific things like you shouldn't take them off, to do yard work or, things that can be done with your garments on. And so there's less of this now. But for a long time, there was some very specific instructions around wearing garments.
Yeah. And what do they do, these garments for the faithful? It sounds like they're seen as a reminder of the promises they make to God in the temple. But they're also a kind of a protection. There are a lot of folk stories in the book interesting about the role of protection, which we can get to some of those. But what are they – for Latter-day Saints, what do they do for them? Garments.
Yeah. So one of the things that I found most fascinating about garments is that – there's been different meanings that have been attributed to garments over the years. And then also people latch on to certain, aspects of garment wearing that are really important to them. But everybody thinks that their meaning of garments is like the meaning of garments. In the 80s and 90s, when purity culture was going really strong, modesty was a huge part of conversation around garments. So, when leaders spoke about them, there was conference talks about how these were meant to cover your body. And now the modesty talk we know is, there's a lot of information now about how that hasn't been the most positive thing. And so now that there's less conversations about modesty, then the language has shifted around them to talk more about that these are a reminder of covenants. And just in the last maybe 2 years, there's also been another shift in the language around garments, saying that they represent like the atonement of Jesus Christ. And that's why they cover your body, is because the atonement's supposed to cover our bodies. And so, just like we were talking about how garment styles are, ever changing, the meaning around garments is also changing. But you're right, there are a lot of kind of like folklore type stories about you know, this person was in a car accident and they were wearing their garments and they had, you know, injuries everywhere except when their garments were touching. I think those stories are less common now, but one thing that we found in the qualitative data that, that you know, Nancy, Jessica, and I, all of us have gotten is that those narratives are actually still present, this idea of protection. And some people think that it's just spiritual protection, but there's still elements of people believing that they will be physically protected when they're wearing their garments. So that idea, some of those ideas are still alive and well within the culture.
You've, I think it was Larissa, I heard you once say, and this, you actually, I think you mentioned this in the book, a few times actually, that one of the themes of the book, one of the major themes of the book is how garments function. Maybe, Jessica, explain what you all mean by that. And any of you, jump in after that.
So in our survey, the majority of respondents really are connecting garments, like Larissa was talking about, to, you know, protection or faith or the temple or their family. So they're imbuing garments with a lot of meaning. It's different from person to person. But then we add this extra layer on top of that symbolism, which is just the practical aspects of having pieces of fabric next to your skin functioning as underwear on the day in and day out, you know, night and day. So unlike other religious clothing where you might, you know, take off a hijab or like remove a collar or a habit to sleep in night clothing, this practice really is very demanding. I would say it's probably one of the most demanding religious practices that we have come across. And we don't talk about it. There's not discussions inside of Mormonism, like there's not discussions outside that really help people weave in that meaning to the practical realities of what it means to their bodies to have something next to their skin, you know, that has been designed maybe not exactly for their body or for their body's needs.
One of the things you mention in the book is that church leaders believe garments serve this social value. That the church's governing first presidency released this letter. This was a statement. This was in 1988, where they said that wearing the garment is, as they put it, an outward expression of an inward commitment. I think the key word there is outward. It's an outward symbol, they said, not a private one, which I think sounds surprising to some. What are you hearing in that statement, the outward versus the inward part? What do you hear in that?
I think that that statement is really interesting. I think the way that you read it kind of even made me think about it. It is interesting because we talk about garments that like this is private or it's personal or we don't talk about these. But then that statement is like, yeah, but this is outward. And so I feel like the statement almost captures kind of what we do in this book, is that there's these like juxtapositions happening where it's like you need to have an outward statement, but also don't talk about it. You know, like it needs to be this, but also this. And like that is, I think, what creates the tensions inside of like a person's body who is wearing these is like, you know, that this needs to be outward. I need to wear it in a certain way. Someone's going to be checking on it. Someone's going to be asking me about it. But also it's supposed to be private and I'm supposed to create meaning around this, but in a very specific way. And so, I, you know, that statement, it really is showing this juxtaposition between sometimes opposing themes around garments.
Well, it gets to an important point you've made in what you saw in the surveys that you've done, the survey, is that you found that the social regulation turned out to be, in some cases, more intense than the institutional regulation. In other words, it was more about social pressure than official policies.
I think that this is where things can kind of get tricky and sticky in some conversations around garments, which is, right, there is no like policy of surveilling your neighbor's garments. Right. But all of this language and all of this, right, like letters like this, like from the first presidency that recognize that this is an outward symbol, lead to the informal surveillance of such things. And so they are very practical operators of like and signifiers of people's faith and level of adherence within the church community. And most people, and they are visible, very visible with inside the community. And this is so tricky and challenging. And so while the church never says, you know, thou shalt surveil thy neighbor, people are really afraid of being of this surveillance. They're afraid of family surveillance, of ward members' surveillance, of church leaders' surveillance. And while there is a real sense of like a gendered hierarchy of power within Mormonism, within the church, you know, just about all boys and men, 11 years old and older, hold the priesthood. This is also judging somebody for the way in which they are wearing garments is an easy way for anyone to kind of claim moral authority in Mormonism. And so that is just really significant. So women then can claim a kind of authority for themselves by engaging in this kind of comment or judgment.
So if you're a church leader,
yeah,
it seems if you want to get people to follow the rules, I don't want to sound crass here, but peer pressure can do a lot of the legwork. You mentioned there's this concept in the book that you mentioned that was developed by the philosopher Foucault called panopticon. And Foucault's idea, if I understand it right, is that when people think they're being watched, they start to regulate themselves. And so religious clothing in this case Mormon garments, makes that kind of self-policing possible without anyone having to enforce it directly. And I guess that's what you're saying. That seems like that's what's working in Mormon culture with garments.
Absolutely. So there's a kind of formal surveillance through temple recommended views that Larissa mentioned. These days they happen once every 2 years. And so then garments are only formally surveilled during those interviews where church leaders ask members if they are wearing their garments day and night throughout their lives. But then the community takes on this informal policing role, and the visibility of garment lines makes that possible. Individuals then internalize that fear of being surveilled and found wanting by other people, and then adjust their behavior accordingly, in part because of the intensity of the pressure that they feel. One thing that we find in the survey is that people tend to experience that a little differently depending on their orientation to belief.
Yeah.
We argue in the book for belief as an intersection of identity, and we use the categories, the broad categories, and this is not perfect language, but of conforming and non-conforming believers to represent those who do and do not experience doubt, and that those who do not experience doubt tend to see their choices as their own, and they feel like I can feel good about the choices I am making, and I am making the choices for me.
Mm. This is about agency, right?
Yeah.
I'm in charge.
About agency, where people who tend to experience doubt also see this system of pressure at play, and they're more easily able to name that they wear garments because of a fear of surveillance. Mm. And a recognition of what being judged and found wanting in this social surveillance system, what kind of impact that will have on them, whether that's family relationships or marital relationships or relationships with others in their church community. But there is a very clear recognition that for people who experience doubt, they're not just making their choices out of a sense of personal commitment and private devotion, but rather because this is a social practice and because they experience tremendous pressure to do so.
Nancy Ross. We're talking with her, Jessica Finnegan, and Larissa Cano Kindred. Their book is called Mormon Garments, Sacred and Secret. It comes out on February 24th. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a new book that explores LDS temple garments. The authors built the book around a survey of Latter-day Saints and the role that garments play in their religious practice, but also in their daily lives. So it moves from the history of these garments, you know, Joseph Smith's original idea, to how they're experienced today. That is, how garments shape ideas about identity and obedience and purity in the body. The book is called Mormon Garments, Sacred and Secret. It comes out later this month. We have with us Nancy Ross, Jessica Finnegan, and Larissa Cano Kindred. Did you think this book would, when you were first putting it together and thinking about writing a book, you thought, well, we've got way more than an article. So we have 4,500 plus responses we need to work through and make sense of. So did you think as you were putting this book together that it would focus mostly on women and their experiences? Because one of the things you mentioned is that the theory you had was that men and women would describe their experience with temple garments in different ways. But you say both men and women, didn't turn out to be the case. Both men and women had really important things to say about them. Talk about that.
I think when we were first putting it together, and we did try to write multiple journal articles and quickly realized there was just too much content to fit into an article. So that's when we started on this book project. But that was my theory, is that we would have men who were largely okay with their garments and that women would report, you know, having difficulties navigating garments around pregnancy and nursing, menopause, breastfeeding, all of those large physical life changes. And the data that we got, like you said, was very surprising, that there were all these layers of meaning and how people interacted with their garments that I had not considered when we started the survey.
I mean, I think some may be puzzled by, well, why would this be a big deal for men? But the men you found who didn't like them said they didn't say they felt physical discomfort or medical issues like women did, but they had these, they said that there were these, you describe as these high emotional costs, that some men felt a kind of shame, for example, about not being able to make choices about their own underwear. So what was the response you were getting from men that was different? It was problematic for both, but what did men say, did you find?
I think the main finding for men, and Larissa and Nancy can add to this, is that, especially for non-conforming believing men, that they saw garments as this spiritual undertaking that they were doing for community reasons, but really did limit their agency, that it impeded their ability to feel that they owned their body, that they were who they thought that they should be. It's kind of like a barrier between them and who they wanted to be. Also, they reported very often a barrier between them and their spouse in terms of garments, both their own garments and then their wives' garments.
Yeah, I think men felt that nonconforming believing men, you know, really reported this shame, this psychological discomfort with the idea that the church was dictating what kind of underwear they needed to wear. You know, men's needs are generally prioritized in the church in a patriarchal system. And I think non-conforming men recognized that they had a lot of choices that they could make and they had a lot of power. But in this very fundamental and basic area of their life, they did not have choices, or their choices were really constrained, or there were a lot of costs around these particular choices. And I think that the sense that they should have power and they should have agency was really challenged by this practice of wearing garments, where, again, you know, garments largely reflect trends and developments in men's underwear. And so it's more the, I am uncomfortable that I cannot make my own choices around this, what kind of clothing I wear, or that I have to wear this kind of clothing. And if I don't wear this kind of clothing, there are really big costs. We just did not see that coming at all. Like, we did not expect this kind of discomfort to be expressed and for it to appear so plainly and so clearly that this particular group was just able to name control as something that really bothered them.
We'll talk about women's experiences with garments here in a moment when we start to get to the way they were designed and thought of. Let me ask the most basic question. Where did Joseph Smith come up with this idea for garments?
You know, I think that is not clear. I think he kind of pieced garments together from a couple of different ideas. Hmm. We have, while our book is, a discussion of our survey data, we do have one chapter on garment history. And
that is fascinating, by the way. I will just say it's fascinating, that history part. And I don't want to glide over it. And I know we're talking about the survey data and it's really important too, but it's incredible.
It is. It really is. Garments really come out of a lot of different things that Joseph Smith is putting together. There's often, I think, the mistaken idea that's kind of floated around that garments really emerge from Freemasonry and the symbols of garments. And there are some ideas around this that do emerge from Freemasonry. But I think that there's a lot more that Joseph Smith is drawing on that's really in the water of like religious and cultural reform in the 1830s and 1840s. Yeah. I think we've got ideas about dress and health that are emerging, particularly concerns over women's health, that, you know, if women wore different clothing, they might be healthier. Joseph Smith is also inspired by angels. Before he creates garments, he's using the language of garments in his letters, in his preaching, in his writings, to kind of symbolize the state of someone's soul, and often makes references to people's garments being washed clean before he has actually constructed the original garments. He describes heavenly visitors like the angel Moroni and even Jesus as wearing a particular type of clothing that designated them as like legitimate heavenly visitors. And so—
Wait. Did he say basic? Was he saying in some ways Jesus wore garments? And in some way, there's this letter that you mentioned by the husband of a seamstress who lived in the early Mormon community. Her name was Elizabeth Warren Allred. And in the letter, it says that Joseph Smith saw, as you said, the angel Moroni wearing garments. And that,
yes.
But that also that he wanted as few seams as possible. I'm reading from the book.
Yes.
Because he wanted these garments, you know, to echo the supposed seamless robe worn by Jesus.
And now I have done a little more work, and I think that to have fewer seams on an item of clothing also meant that the item of clothing was more luxurious. But I think that there is some of that in the works. We see references in various points to Jesus being described as wearing these same garments. And later church leaders describe Jesus in various visions as wearing garments. And again, I don't think that Joseph is drawing on just one source. Right. I feel like there are a lot of things in the water here. And he's kind of drawing on a lot of different ideas. He is both creating a new practice, a new religious practice, and he is changing a form of underwear. And I do absolutely describe it as progressive, certainly within the world of the 1830s and the 1840s. But it's also, he's trying to make it like both progressive and kind of ancient at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
I feel like that feels like what Joseph was trying to do in a lot of different arenas with his religious innovations. I think that that is, for someone who does not have a great love of Joseph Smith, I feel like that's my most generous take.
So he's mixing the idea, his idea of innovation and reform with his love of symbols and ceremony.
Yes, absolutely. And with an understanding that I think he takes from Freemasonry, that there's a lot of power in clothing as a ritual symbol. Mm-hmm. And then he's really running with that. And ultimately, then these early garments are symbolic of so many things, with their symbols borrowed from Freemasonry, with their ties to angels, with their ties to Jesus, with their ties to the kind of contemporary culture and conversations around dress and health. and also, you know, polygamy, and then Adam and Eve, right? Like, from the very beginning, garments take on a lot of different meanings, and those meanings continue to evolve. There's just, like, a lot going on here.
Larissa, I wanted to ask you about one of the things you mentioned in the book is that at first, garments were connected to the part of temple rituals that served to legitimize the practice of polygamy. So they're tied to polygamy at first. What happens when Latter-day Saints no longer practice plural marriage? What happens after that? What's the new meaning that plays out?
You know, I think that this is another one of the things that we don't have tons of clarity on, but there is some things that indicate that it was only people who practiced polygamy at the beginning that wore garments. But then, you know, over time, as the church starts to separate from that practice, I think that's when we start seeing the narratives change around garment wearing. You can see this really clearly because if you look at, you know, fundamentalist groups, they still wear the one-piece garment, and they have a very, very, like, intense relationship with their garments, probably what it would have looked like, you know, for early members of the church. So they may be even practicing a more pure version of wearing garments. Theirs has not evolved in the same ways that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, their practice has evolved, and the fundamentalist groups has not evolved in that same way. And so you kind of see how you have these groups that really, like, latched on to, like, this is how we wear garments, and it's the one piece, and that's what was inspired, and so we're going to wear this. And they also practice polygamy still. And so you can see how those are still tied together. And then you actually watch how garments start to shift in their meaning as the church separates more from polygamy and the garments become more mainstream. Everybody is wearing them, but the language around starts to change. And, you know, in the early 1900s, there was more conversation about, like, you know, we're a peculiar people. And so we wear these to show that we're separate from the world. And, you know, and so you see them start to change and progress as the church separates from the practice of polygamy. And of course, around that time, the church, like, they wanted statehood. And so the church wanted to become more mainstream. I think that's been a social project that has been ongoing for a long time. And I think that garments kind of follow the church's journey of becoming a more mainstream Christian sect.
That's Larissa Cano Kindred, along with Jessica Finnegan and Nancy Ross. Their book is Mormon Garments, Sacred and Secret. It comes out later this month on the 24th. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a new book coming out later this month that tells the story of the temple garments worn by members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and other Mormon sects. The book is called Mormon Garments, Sacred and Secret. We have with us the authors Nancy Ross, Larissa Cano Kindred, and Jessica Finnegan. You include your own stories in the book at various points. And Larissa, you write about your experience first wearing these garments. You mentioned that you could tell they were not made for your body. And one of the dimensions to your story is that you are biracial, your father is Japanese. And you say wanting to wear garments was kind of tied to wanting to feel validated and accepted. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I think this is a huge function of garments within Mormon culture, is that it's kind of a rite of passage. So you get them when you first go to the temple. So it's an indicator that, like, you're doing the things that you are supposed to do. You're transitioning into adulthood, you know, righteously and in an appropriate way. And I think for anybody who has an identity that is not, if you have a marginalized identity in any way in the church, if you're neurodiverse, if you're LGBTQ, if you're a person of color, if you're outside of what is kind of seen as, like, this is the mainstream, then I think that that type of validation of feeling like you belong in this space can be very elusive. And I think for me that was my experience. And I think that came not only from, like, a racial perspective, but also like my family was very poor when I was growing up. That is something that can be kind of stigmatizing within the church. And then also my parents were divorced.
Yeah.
I always feel like those were kind of like the three strikes against me, is that we were in a very, very homogenous area. So my siblings and I were some of the only people of color around. There was always this kind of sense of like not quite being able to be in the inner, you know, in the inner circle of Mormon culture. And so I think going through these kind of traditional rituals for me was hugely about being validated within the system, because it was so, that was something that was so hard for me to get at. And so I think for a lot of people, that can be something really positive about wearing garments, especially in the beginning, is to feel like, okay, I'm doing adulthood in the way that my mom and dad told me to do. And I'm, you know, I'm going through the steps, and I made it to the temple, and this is such a big thing. And so now these garments are now a symbol that I belong in this system. I'm now somebody who is doing the right thing within this community.
You also talk about a time after you had surgery for breast cancer, where you stopped wearing your garments for a time while you're recuperating. You were wearing some compression clothing. And tell us a little bit about what it felt like to put your garments back on, because you said when you did, it had this, as you put it in the book, an overstimulating effect on your body. Can you describe that reaction you were having?
Yeah. You know, I wore my garments really consistently when I was a practicing member of the church. And so because they were so tied to like feeling validated in the system, I didn't ask a lot of questions, and I wore them the way that they told me to. And so I really hadn't pushed back. And then, and then I was diagnosed and then treated for breast cancer. I had a, you know, a double mastectomy, and then was just supposed to wear compression clothing for a while. And so it was really the first time in my life I had gone through a long period of time where I wasn't wearing my garments. I think two things happened to me at that time. One of them was physical, and then I think the other was very much psychological. So number one, once I started wearing my garments again, I feel like I didn't realize before that it was very overstimulating to me. I'm a neurodiverse person, and I know a lot of other people who have any type of sensory, you know, sensitivities have had this experience of it's just a lot of fabric on you. And so it was kind of just like this awareness of like, oh, wow, like this is what this feels like. And I've been feeling this for a long time. And this is actually really, really hard to put these back on. And then the second element of that, I think, was very psychological. I felt so much that cancer took something from me. And there was so many elements of my experience with that that I could not control. And so I really like developed this mindset of like, I want to get my body back. Like cancer maybe took A, B, and C from me, but I can't let it take everything. And I have to like get this back. I want to feel like I'm still young and healthy and vibrant. I wanted to like fight for that feeling. And there was something about putting my garments on that I really kind of connected, that like, I can't feel like I'm in control, and I can't feel like I'm really like taking ownership back over my body if I wear this item. And I'll say with that, I want to add some nuance to it, that I think there's probably women that have gone through similar experiences, men and women, and that they actually, their garments maybe even gave them comfort during that time. Yeah. Or I feel so good being back in my garments. So I don't think my experience is indicative of everybody's. But for me, in that experience at that time, I couldn't kind of reclaim, you know, ownership over my body while also wearing something that somebody told me to do that didn't feel good and that had been, you know, difficult to navigate in my life.
One of the things you point out in the book doesn't tell people to stop wearing their garments. You have a measure of respect for, you know, people's own personal reasons and ideas about them. But that said, do you think it may be time to rethink garments, that they might have outlived their purpose, that when you're weighing the costs versus the benefits that you see? Granted, these are anecdotal responses in this survey, but there were a lot of them. Have garments been a net positive or a net negative for Latter-day Saints? Not that you've come to any conclusions about that, but what do you think?
I think it would depend on the person. And I think that, like, in my work, and I'm in a psychology field, and I've looked at some, like, cross-cultural comparing with women in other religions and how they relate to their religious clothing. And garments, because they are underwear, I just think it adds so much difficulty to the practice. And also, they lose some of the protective elements that we see that women get when they are, you know, Jewish women that wear religious clothing or Muslim women who are wearing hijab. Mm-hmm. A lot of them cite certain protective factors or identity type things. And I think that garments, because of the fact that they are underwear, they lose some of those protective factors. And then they also have this huge complexity because of what, you know, biologically women are going through in their bodies. And so, yeah, I think it would have to really be like an individual conversation, because in my research that I've done, and Nancy and Jessica and their research, it's interesting that devout women will say, these are really, really hard for me to wear, but it's so important for me to wear them. Mm. But I will say that I think the thing that I want for women who wear garments is I want women to have the freedom to create their own meaning and then engage with them how they want to. So my concerns are primarily with institutional and then social regulation, because I think if we want something to be meaningful to us, we have to be able to engage and navigate with it in a way that works for us. And I think for some women, if they could wear their garments just to the temple, they might actually have a better relationship with their garments than wearing them every day and having to navigate, you know, all the complexities of wearing them every day as underwear. And so I actually think the more openness we have, the more meaningful they will become. But then we have to ask the question, like, then do we lose some element of social control? And how important is that in these types of institutions?
Nancy Russ, I want to ask you this question finally. You tell this story of your own experience. You were 23 when you got your own garments. You went to the you went through the temple in London. You were studying in Cambridge. You write about it as being this proud moment of becoming an adult. And you say you were a rule follower, but you had this experience where you needed to ask a question. You wanted some clarification. And one of the questions was, maybe this was the critical question, like, am I supposed to wear these under or over my bra? And so you ask a temple matron there who says it was a very rude question. And what I want to ask you about that is the reaction that you had, because you write this in the book, that experience taught you this, that it was, as you put it, your job, your body's job, to hold this tension between official teaching and the complexity of lived experience in silence. Could you say something about that tension, I guess, finally for us?
Yeah. It's almost as though, within this belief framework, whatever God requires, we must just kind of accept, and that we must kind of accept it without complaint and regardless of the cost. And that is something I tried very hard to do for a long time. Both Jessica and Larissa and I all wore garments, all tried to do this for a long time. We were all rule-following good Mormon women. And that the kind of silence we were expected to maintain and the cost to ourselves and our bodies and all that we would have to give up to make this work was ultimately a cost we would not be able to continue to pay. And for myself anyway, a cost that I will spend the rest of my life undoing. That's not a small thing, that when the institution asks people to wear next to their skin and to always engage in a particular spiritual practice forever and always, you know, night and day throughout our lives, it's asking and making a lot of assumptions in the process of asking. There's a lot of pathologizing of people for when their practice of Mormonism does not feel good. And we all experienced that and then felt a strong need to give voice to that, and how these costs eventually grated against faith.
Nancy Ross. She's an associate professor of interdisciplinary studies at Utah Tech University. She joined us along with her co-authors, the scholars Jessica Finnegan and Larissa Cano Kindred. Their book is called Mormon Garments, Sacred and Secret. It's coming out later this month. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.